Yeah, I'm just going to go right down the line here.
I read from the House, you said.
Right. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 6-2.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 62 specifies the grounds for which a claim may be filed against a landscaping business bond and allows an agent of a property owner to file a claim against a landscaping business bond. It limits the amount that a non-owner may recover from a single landscaping business bond and the amount that may be recovered from a landscaping business bond for the cost, interest, and attorney fees to no more than $3,000 each. It also adjusts the language regarding the recovery of arbitration awards from a bond or other security of a landscaping business and also gives the Landscape Contractors Board express authority to use mediation or other forms of alternative dispute resolution as outlined by the board's guidelines.
Thank you. And we have Mike Snyder with the Landscapers Board here. Mike, you want to just come up and tell us what we're doing here? I think I hear Representative Berger.
Yep.
You think? Chair Schaffler and members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Mike Snyder. I'm the administrator for the State Landscape Contractors Board. This bill, Senate Bill 62, is before you because during the last session, we introduced legislation and got it approved to increase the bonding amount for landscaping businesses that perform landscape work in Oregon based on the amount of the projects that they're doing. So we have what we call a step bond process. In that legislation, we failed to limit the amount that goes to non-consumer or non-owner claims. So right now we're exposed with the bond to people that are suppliers, attorney fees and that type of thing, where our mission is really to protect the consumer that are having a contractual relationship with the landscaping business doing work on their property. So this bill is, the primary reason to have this bill is to limit that to a $3,000 amount, which is very, it mirrors what the Construction Contractor Board have already. The other part of this bill is to grant the Landscape Contractors Board the ability to use mediation in the dispute resolution process that we use to satisfy the claims or complaints that come into the board about licensed landscaping businesses. We have followed the construction contractors model, and it was just during the last session we realized that we did not have the expressed authority to do mediation, which is a very effective method for us in terms of resolving these disputes. In fact, 95% of the claims that we have, we do resolve through mediation and have the consumer and the landscaping business write a settlement agreement that takes care of the issues that they don't have to go to court and that's resolved for them. So then it also allows the bond to pay for a lien. Sometimes landscaping businesses don't pay for their materials, and the material supplier will file a lien on the homeowner's property, and we need that bond to be able to pay that lien off so we can get that off of the homeowner's record. That's what this bill does.
Thanks.
Mr. Cross
is in another hearing, and he told me that the Landscapers Association is supportive of this and the next bill, 63, as well. So I just wanted to get that on the record, too.
Great. Thank you.
Any questions, Representative Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Snyder, thanks for coming forward. As you know, we went through some issues around bonds for decks that attach to the building envelopes in another committee. And so I'm wondering what kind of consistency we will have between construction contractors that build decks to attach to buildings with their bond amounts and the bond amounts that I'm seeing here.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Holby, what if, in fact, the House Bill 2656 goes through, that allows landscaping businesses to attach decks, the bonding amount is supposed to be equal to what construction contractors have, and the insurance requirements are the same.
Okay.
So it's tied to their bonding amount and to their insurance requirements.
Thank you. I just wanted to get that on the record because it isn't in this particular
bill. That's correct.
So at some point, that's going to have to be
rectified. It's spelled out, I think, in the bill, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Any more questions, Mr. Snyder? Representative Escobar.
Okay, I'm going to ask probably maybe a silly question, but let's say we have an individual that builds a retaining wall. I'm leading the one in Grants Pass, probably what you're a little aware of over there, where it was done by a contractor. It failed and did extensive damage to the back of the house. And I want to say it was approaching $75,000 or something of that nature. What do you do in a situation like that? I mean, you have a $10,000 or $15,000 bond, but we're still short $60,000.
Two things would be, Chair Schaffer, Representative Escobar, two things would come into play there. One is the bond amount for negligent work on the retaining wall.
E&O or something like that. Like an errand admission.
Well,
it's a bond.
The bond is about what we have as does the Construction Contractors Board. Our bond is what we call a surety bond. It's not a performance bond. And so what happens is the business signs that bond to the Landscape Contractors Board. If a consumer complains about the work, they file what we call a claim with the Landscape Contractors Board, and they outline what the issues were that they are complaining about. Now, if a retaining wall fell down, let's say in your case, and the retaining wall fell down, that would be negligent work. And if there was damage to the house, then the insurance would cover that part of the process. However, we would go to that job site meet with the homeowner, meet with the landscaping business, the owner of that business, and we would try to reach a resolution. Obviously, the wall fell down. There's cost involved in taking care of that. And we would assess damages, you know, to what is the actual damage here and how much is it going to cost to resolve it. Now, the contracting business can say, I will pay those damages, because we probably wouldn't, as a board, allow that same business to go back in and build that wall again, demonstrating that they weren't competent to do that. But they could pay those damages. If they decide, no, I'm not going to pay the damages, then the bond would pay out the maximum amount the bond could pay, and there would still be a judgment against that landscaping business for the remaining amount of the damages. That business then would have their license suspended until such time as they made a payment plan, started resolving that issue with the homeowner.
Very good. Thank you.
Any further questions? All righty then. Stay right where you are, though. We're going to do the next one, too. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 62 and open a work session on Senate Bill 62. Representative Escobar.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 62 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Escobar moves Senate Bill 62 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? And just for the record, I don't know anything about this case, but there's a lot of things that can make a wall fail, not just the construction of it. The soil, erosion, the code itself that was inspected under could be inaccurate or lacking. But anyway, I want to throw that in there. Beat up on contractors.
Earthquake.
Yeah, earthquake. Any number. Kristen, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. Would anyone like to volunteer to carry this bill on the floor?
I'll do it for you.
Thank you, Representative. Close work session on Senate Bill 62 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 63A.
Mr. Chair, committee member, Senate Bill 63A requires an applicant for the initial issuance or renewal of a landscape contractor or landscape business license to notify the Landscape Contractors Board of any unpaid court judgment, arbitration award, or administrative agency final order that requires the applicant to pay damages that arises out of the performance of or contract of landscaping work. The bill establishes the failure to notify the board as required as grounds for the suspension, revocation, or refusal to renew a license. It also subjects licensees who fail to provide this notice to civil penalties that apply to other violations of licensing law. And the measure only applies to judgments, awards, or final orders that are issued on or after the effective date of January 2nd, 2008.
Thank you, Teresa. Mike, you want to go ahead and tell us what we're doing on this one, please?
Chair Schaffer, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Mike Snyder. I'm the administrator for the Landscape Contractors Board.
Thank you.
This bill, the intent of this bill is to gather information about licensees that have judgments or tort orders or awards that have incurred or caused landscaping damage which is incurred for the business of what we call landscaping debt, for not taking care of those damages that they have done. Currently, the only ones that we have any kind of knowledge about are the ones that we do administratively through the claim process that we just talked about previously. That if there's a claim filed, then we have record of all that information. If there's an order filed, they owe that money to the claimant. We have knowledge of that. Now, if a landscaping business is taken to court, they bypass our process, then that judgment is outside of our jurisdiction, and we have no knowledge about that at all. So we're asking for this bill to require landscaping businesses or landscaping individuals to notify the board, and the original bill said within 30 days of having that judgment come in effect. We had some opposition to that, and we decided that we would allow that to happen at a time of renewal and a time of application only. We could live with that and see how that all works. So we've amended the bill to say that at the time of application or at the time of renewal, they must tell us if they have any outside judgments, awards, arbitration things against them. In that case, if they have not resolved that, in other words, if there's no payment plan in place or some other way that they're taking care of that issue, we can issue a suspension of license. If they don't notify us and we find out about it later, we can issue a civil penalty of up to $2,000 and suspend their license.
Thank you. It makes perfect sense to me. Your original bill had a 60-day...
30-day.
I would have voted for that, too. Any questions? All right. You did a great job, Mike. So
thank you.
We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 633A and open a work session on Senate Bill 633A. Representative Fisco.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 633A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquel moves Senate Bill 633A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Kristen, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Pardon me?
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse me.
Aye.
Aye. Would anyone like to carry this fine bill on the floor? I guess the chair will. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 63A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 88A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 88A extends the sunset on the continuing education requirement for renewing a water well constructor's license and for the Well Constructors Continuing Education Committee to exist to January 2, 2014. The bill also establishes a fee of $40 per credit hour, not to exceed $250 for a full-day course for agency-sponsored training. And it also modifies fees for the initial issuance and the renewal of a well constructor's license to $150.
Thank you. Debbie Colbert and Jerry Schmidt, please.
And Mr. Chair, while they're coming forward, this is not a comment on any particular bill, but now that we're getting these Senate bills, I think it'd be helpful to see what the vote was.
Oh, sir. Actually, Mr. Chair, Representative, I can tell you the vote on this bill. It passed unanimously at the Business, Transportation, and Workforce Development Committee, and there was a vote of 24-3 in the Senate.
And Representative, I've asked the question of every one of these bills of the committee administrator, because if there is any division for any reason, I'm interested in that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I can reiterate that all the bills here today have either passed out of the Senate unanimously. They've all passed out unanimously out of their respective Senate committees and have had either unanimous or one or two no votes.
Token opposition.
Yes.
Very good.
Thank you.
Ms. Colbert, thank you.
Again, for the record, I'm Debbie Colbert. I'm with the Water Resources Department. And I guess I would just start by saying that Senate Bill 88 was originally introduced by the governor on behalf of the Water Resources Department. It's a bill that, as committee staff told you, that deals with our continuing education program for well constructors and also the terms and fees for well constructors. I just note that well construction has been regulated by the state for many decades. We have about 650 licensed well constructors in the state. They're licensed through the Water Resources Department. In 2001, Senate Bill 579 passed, and that bill did a couple things. It adjusted the fees and the terms for the license for well constructors.
Thank you.
And it also set up for the first time a continuing education program for well constructors. The Senate Bill 88A would do a number of things. It essentially maintains and makes permanent those fee and term that were established in 2001. It extends the sunset on the continuing education program, and it specifies the fees that we have to charge for courses that we offer. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Jerry, promise me you're not going to read these three pages of testimony.
I promise.
Okay, then you can proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Schmidt. I'm here today representing the Oregon Groundwater Association. They are the well constructors, pump installers, consulting hydrogeologists, manufacturers, and suppliers. I'm only speaking here on aspect of the well constructors. The meat of this bill is on page 3, lines 13 through 18. That's the changes in the bill that, as it was submitted, it was Senate Bill 88, and then those were the substantive changes that you see there in lines 13 through 18 on page 3. And the issue there was just to make sure that if the department is sponsoring classes and offering continuing education classes, that they establish a fee so it remains revenue neutral. Our concern is that everything the department does, they have to pay for it, and it comes out of one portion of the budget or another. So if, in fact, they're entering into this area, they need to charge a fee for it so that everything is neutral. I don't have anything to add. There are some other issues that we're working with the department on. I think we don't need to bore the committee's time, and I think they've been working with us to try and solve some of the issues, so we can work together with them on it administratively. So thank you, and I'm free for any questions if the committee has any.
Thanks. Any questions, these folks?
Yes, Representative. Yeah. What kind of continuing education are we talking about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, it's a fairly wide range of continuing ed. Most of the education aims specifically at safety issues, because the drilling equipment is highly sophisticated, lots of mechanical things. There is a lot of safety issues. They have continuing ed on a wide gamut of things, from first aid to geology to, I can't even think of all the different areas. One of the things required by statute is to make sure that they have at least 2 hours of continuing education credit on administrative rules of the department. And the reason for that was trying to keep the drillers current with what's happening in the statutory and administrative changes. So that's the parameters that they're working with. It's not, there is some general classes even in business practices where they have people come in and actually give them continuing education on, because these are mainly small businesses, and we'll have classes on proper business, proper labor practices, and those type of things.
Yes, Representative, please.
If I could ask, how many hours of continuing education are they required to have?
Mr. Chair, Representative, they're required to have 14 credits every 2-year license term. And two of them, as Mr. Schmidt mentioned, two of them have to be in our rule and regulations, two of those 14.
And, Mr. Chair, could I continue?
Yes, please.
Your rules and regulations change that much that they need that? I mean, are you constantly changing your rules and regulations?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do have a Groundwater Advisory Committee, Continuing Education Committee that meets pretty regularly, and as we make adjustments to rules, even every other year, we incorporate those into those classes. So we don't do rulemakings every year, but any changes would be incorporated in those 2-year requirements.
And let me just chime in. Anytime you're dealing with water, Representative Berger, I think every 2 years is a good idea to be refreshed.
Mr. Chair, may I say, anytime you're dealing with a bureaucracy,
amen,
you need
sister.
To be refreshed. I won't
argue
all
that.
The time. I'm sorry.
I won't argue that.
You know what I'm objecting
I
to.
I do. I can appreciate that, Representative. I can, believe me. And I think you're right. Any further comments or questions of these nice people?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking on page 3 of this bill, and granted that the monies will be used to pay the department's expenses associated with education, but couldn't these fees also be used for the Water Resources Department and the Water Resources Commission for its operating expenses, administrative expenses? And
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that as we were having discussions about the amendments that OGWA wanted, they specifically wanted to limit us to only being able to use the expenses for the continuing education program and not other purposes.
Mm-hmm. So when it says notwithstanding ORS 536009, I mean, that's basically the Water Resources Department, Water Resources Commission. So I read that to say that they could use it for the commission and the department as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that was Ledge Council felt that in order to be consistent with 537009, they had to specifically say, notwithstanding the direction in that part of the statute, this is how we must spend any fees collected through this program.
If I had my way, they would take the word notwithstanding out of the entire statute. No one has ever told me what it really means. Any further questions of these nice people? Representative, would you like to follow up?
No, I think she put it on the record for
okay.
me.
Okay, good. Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 88A and open a work session on Senate Bill 88A. Representative Escobar.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 88A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Escobar moves Senate Bill 88A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. Do I have a volunteer?
Okay. You don't want me, Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Berger, I'm confident you could carry any bill there most proficiently.
Yeah, well, I'd rather not carry this.
Sal, you want to carry it? Okay. Representative Esquivel, forgive me. Okay, very good. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 88A. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 182.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 182 authorizes the Oregon Board of Accountancy to grant a time extension for business organizations of certified public accountants or public accountants to meet the existing statutory requirement that a majority of the business's ownership belong to licensed accountants. Thank you, Representative Rosemont, for reminding me about the votes. It passed unanimously out of the Business, Transportation, Workforce Development Committee and out of the Senate with a 23-2 vote.
And we have Carol Reeves. Come and tell us all about this, please.
Good late afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carol Reese. I'm the administrator for the Board of Accountancy. I thank you very much, Chair Soffler, for giving us the opportunity to discuss this bill with you today. This bill will provide greater flexibility for public accounting firms when they are trying to meet the ownership requirements for those firms. Historically, public accounting firms are owned by licensed public accountants, whether they be certified public accountants or public accountants, which are the two levels of licensing that we issue. In recent years, however, public accounting services have expanded and firms have diversified the services that they provide to their clients. This diversification of services allowed clients to utilize the expertise and the knowledge and the history that their public accounting firm had with them and also meet additional needs of the client. In recognition of the need to provide expertise in service areas that are non-traditional and that do not necessarily require a certified public accountant license, public accounting firms increased their staff to include individuals who had expertise and experience in these different areas. These might have been financial planning, for example, investing, perhaps insurance, different areas that a certified public accountant or public accountant is not necessarily licensed. State boards of accountancy across the country have acknowledged this need for the transition in public accounting services by relaxing the firm ownership requirements. And the change in 1999 in Oregon, our statute was modified to allow public accounting firms to be owned 51% by the licensed professionals and 49% by non-public accountants or non-licensees. No less than 51% may be owned by the licensees. The purpose of this is to be sure that the business decisions of the organization are made by individuals who are subject to the Code of Professional Conduct and the professional standards that public accountants must adhere to, rather than being influenced by those who don't have the same standards that they must answer to. It is this situation, however, that has caused a small problem recently. The 51-49 ownership balance is rather delicate, and it can be upset very easily with the death of a certified public accountant, perhaps a change of employment. And in order to meet these needs, extraordinary needs, the board would like to allow an extension of time for those firms who no longer have the 51% ownership balance that is required, but only in circumstances that are beyond their control. For example, death would be one, the death of a licensee. Another one might be revocation of a licensee, but we don't want to look in that direction. If it is merely a matter of retirement or changing position to a different firm, those are situations in which the firm should have been making advanced planning and have arranged to have the appropriate ownership in their firm. If a firm does not have the 51% ownership that is required, the firm registration would be terminated, and they would not be able to provide professional services to their clients until they met those requirements again. So in these situations where the change of ownership is out of their control, the firm would not be terminated, and the firm would be able to continue providing services to their clients for a period of time that is determined by the board by rule, and until they can meet the balance. The rule that the board anticipates is one that says either in 180 days or at the time of the next renewal, whichever is longer. So that's the time period that would be allowed for this planning. The board believes this provision maintains public protection because it assures that business decisions will be made by the licensed professionals, and it also allows continuity of business during the period of a transition. I would be happy to answer any questions
thank
you may have.
Any questions? And Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to know how often accountants have to be renewed their licenses.
This is a firm registration.
Or a firm, excuse me.
However, the answer is the same, Mr. Chair, Representative
great.
Colby. It is every 2 years. Firm registrations occur every 2 years, as do individual licensing renewals.
So they could possibly have almost 2 years
yes.
to comply to this?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Carol, I don't know if you were here in 1999. I wasn't. And these are esoteric things. But if there was no extension when there was a 100% mandate, however did you do it that you need this emergency clause on a 50% mandate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I was not here in 1999, but to the best of my knowledge, the firm would have been terminated until they could get the appropriate ownership. However, let us think this through. At 100% ownership, you either had a CPA in that firm who was the owner, or you didn't.
And he died, you were done.
Right. Or you brought in another CPA. It was sold, and you brought in another CPA. Usually, however, the situation that you are suggesting would be a sole proprietor. That would be the most logical situation where there was only a single licensee owning the firm. If you have a partnership, a limited liability corporation, a limited liability partnership, invariably there were more than one. And in fact, there had to be more than one licensee if the name of the firm indicates that there's more than one licensee working in that firm. So the only situation that would have occurred where the single owner was the licensee and died, that would have been the demise of the business.
It appears that it would. Thank you.
Yeah. Welcome, Representative Escobar.
So why, let's say, Mr. CPA Schmuckacoli owns his own business here, and he passes away, why wouldn't the state have the ability to come in, hire or have the heirs hire a CPA to finish out the work that was in progress and take on no more work and then wind the business down that way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, in fact, there's a rule that allows that winding down in the situation of the death of a sole proprietor. I'm sorry I didn't mention it. I'm glad you thought about that. But there is an administrative rule that allows the business to continue for winding down purposes. And it doesn't involve the intervention of the agency or of the board, rather. The family of the estate would manage that.
Any more questions of Ms. Reeves? All right. Thank you very much, Carol.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 182. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 182. Representative Esquivel.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 182 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 182 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Kristen?
Aye.
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 Excuse?
Aye.
Aye. Would anyone like to carry this fine bill? Representative Edwards, thank you very much. Close work session on Senate Bill 182 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 195.
Mr. Chair, Committee Member, Senate Bill 195 limits the types of employment that will end an individual's disqualification from receiving unemployment insurance benefits to employment that is subject to tax that is imposed by the Federal Unemployment Tax Act and employment that is required to be covered under state employment department law as a condition for employers to receive federal tax credit. It passed out of the Senate Commerce Committee and unanimously and out of the Senate with a 24-2 vote.
Thank you. We have Mr. Byerly here to tell us what we're doing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Byerly. I'm Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance with the Employment Department. Here to testify on Senate Bill 195. As the committee administrator indicated, Senate Bill 195 changes the requalifying requirements for an individual who has been disqualified from the receipt of unemployment insurance benefits for reason of their job separation, either a quit or a discharge, or if they refuse an offer of work. Currently, the situation is if you are disqualified under that, under those provisions, you can requalify for unemployment insurance if you go to work in any type of work and earn an amount that's equal to or greater than four times your weekly benefit amount. So if your weekly benefit amount is $300, you need to work and earn $1,200. Frequently, we see individuals go paint their grandmother's fence or re-roof their neighbor's house or overhaul their brother-in-law's car engine, and often that type of work is hard to validate or verify. And in fact, sometimes when we send investigators out, it cannot be verified. It wasn't bona fide employment, and therefore they're misrepresenting facts to receive their unemployment insurance benefits. This bill would change the law and require that to requalify for unemployment insurance benefits, you would need to work for an employer that pays in to the unemployment insurance tax system, pays into our trust fund, their premiums, to cover that employment. Our goal in doing this is to shore up the integrity of the UI Trust Fund and cut down on some of the misrepresentation that's going on in this area. That's not to say everybody cheats on those types of work, but some do. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Any questions, Representative Berger?
Other states have similar provisions. Are you aware?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Berger, other states do have this provision. That's correct.
I'm sort of surprised we don't.
This is why, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, this is another one of those. I was asked on the Senate side, why didn't you do this sooner?
Well, duh.
Sorry.
Okay. Sooner is now.
Yeah. Any further questions of Mr. Byerly? All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Anyone else want to testify today to this bill? Okay. Close the work public hearing on Senate Bill 195 and open a work session on Senate Bill 195. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 195 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 195 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Excuse?
Aye.
Aye. And Representative Berger, would you like to carry this bill?
Oh, I would be thrilled.
I thought you might. I want to hear the well.
I would be thrilled.
I want the well duh written into your speech.
Well
too.
Duh.
Okay. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 195. Anything for the good of the order other than have a good weekend?
Have
all
a
right.
Good weekend. Mr. Chair.
Representative Esquivel, what was the name of that individual?